So those of you who know the history of this program know that something huge and memorable and totally unexpected often happens in the news when I'm away on vacation. Things like the Great Northeast Blackout, or Jim McGreevy suddenly announcing that he's gay and resigning as governor of New Jersey, or the capture of Saddam Hussein. So we are always on the lookout for the big or the bizarre story when I dare to take some time off. This year, I would say, there was no single planet-stopping occurrence over the last 2 weeks, but the last 2 weeks have actually been extremely eventful. You know, I try to get kind of off the news wheel when I go to the Adirondacks in the summer, as I did the last 2 weeks, but I look at the headlines every day, and there were plenty of things that made me go, oh, wow. So just in the last couple of weeks, WikiLeaks dropped their 70,000-document bombshell, which could wind up dramatically altering the war in Afghanistan. Charles Wrangel and Maxine Waters were charged by the House Ethics Committee. We've been waiting for that Wrangel finding for a long time. Now a public trial seems likely. Governor Patterson was cleared of criminal wrongdoing, but not really exonerated in the Sharona Booker case. Sean Bell's family and other victims of that police shooting from several years ago got a $7 million settlement from the city. The Arizona immigration law and Proposition 8, the gay marriage ban in California, both got struck down in court. New York State got an actual budget 4 months late and many billions short. The Anti-Defamation League came out against the Ground Zero Mosque, but the Landmarks Preservation Commission refused to block it. The BP oil spill suddenly became not as bad as advertised, or at least was feared. Daniel Shore died. Elena Kagan got confirmed. A-Rod hit his 600th home run. And it was an interesting 2 weeks for political daughters. Chelsea Clinton got married. Bristol Palin got re-unengaged. And Caroline Giuliani got busted for shoplifting on the Upper East Side. So that's really a lot of news for 2 weeks, a lot of things that are not quite, I'll always remember where I was when the lights went out, but pretty big stuff from War News to the People page, and those were just the top headlines. So now, folks, it is your turn. What else did I miss the last 2 weeks that is worth knowing about? Listeners, you be the editor. You contribute ideas every day anyway, so call in now and give us something from the news of the last 2 weeks worth knowing, or you can give us your take on any of the developments that I just listed. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. You be the summer editor, the big story of the last 2 weeks, according to you. 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. Susan Page is here, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today, to help with our whirlwind tour. Hi, Susan.
Hey, Brian. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. So I thought I would kind of go down the list of stories that I mentioned and ask you maybe one follow-up question on each of the national stories, since they are not brand new news, okay?
That sounds good.
WikiLeaks. Here is Defense Secretary Robert Gates just after the documents were released.
The battlefield consequences of the release of these documents are potentially severe and dangerous.
So, Susan, what, as far as you can tell, because it's been fully 2 weeks now, have been the military consequences of the release and the political consequences?
Well, I think that we don't yet know the consequences on the battlefield. I haven't seen good stories that look at what's happened on the battlefield, although we did hear from the Taliban spokesman, who is a guy you can call if you're a reporter, who said that the Taliban was looking through the WikiLeaks disclosures to identify people he said were spies and to punish them. That sounds kind of alarming. We also know there are criminal investigations going on by the Army and by the FBI, and that Bradley Manning, the private who is suspected at having like this, is at Quantico being held, a small demonstration there yesterday of some activists seeking his release.
Do you foresee a change, of course, in the war or the American people's view of the war as a result of this? Again, the vague impression that I was getting when not following very closely, but, you know, looking at a little bit of stuff up there, was that people around the country were reacting with great alarm to an apparent revelation that the war was not going as well as claimed.
You know, it wasn't so much that it was a big surprise, the findings in WikiLeaks, but it did focus everyone's attention once more on the war in Afghanistan. We've seen some steady, small erosion in support for the war in Afghanistan over the past year or so. And what we found in the USA Today Gallup poll, which we took about 10 days ago, was a big jump in those who said the decision to go send the military to Afghanistan was a mistake. That's our fundamental question for support on the war. And the assessment of President Obama's handling of the war went down in a significant way. This seems to be a result of the WikiLeaks case. So I think we're seeing some political consequences, and I think it does put President Obama on the spot to explain and defend his policy more than he's done in the recent past.
All right. Congressman Rangel, charged with 13 ethics violations by the House Ethics Committee. Here is Rangel just after that announcement on July 29th.
To me, even though this is not a great day for me, the only good that I can find is that there's no inference of corruption at all.
So you're laughing. You want to fact check that distinction he was making? Ethics violations charged, but no corruption?
Well, I think that what the congressman meant was that it wasn't that someone gave him some money and he took action on the floor of the House. But what did happen, according to the Ethics Committee, is that he raised money for an institution at the City College of New York in his name, using his congressional office. He failed to report taxable income from a villa he has in the Dominican Republic. That's a little embarrassing since he was at the time heading the tax writing committee. He was renting four rent-controlled apartments in New York City. I think that's probably something that resonates with some of your listeners. So I guess you go back to a Clintonite question, which is it depends on what the meaning of corruption is.
I guess. But wasn't one of the biggest things that he did take big donations from a company that he then turned around as chairman of the Ways and Means Committee and helped to get like $500 million in tax breaks?
Yes. Now, he says that there was no quid pro quo there. But I think it is, I think to most listeners, it's unpersuasive to hear Congressman Rangel say this. And I think to most Democrats who are also going to be on the ballot in November, it is unhelpful to think about a public trial of one of the senior Democrats in the House as we go into this fall election season.
Right. And so I guess, part of what he's saying is that he didn't take money in the old style corruption sense, like all these people who were indicted in New Jersey over the last year, to benefit himself personally. Maybe money went to this center that he has at City College, but that's not him taking the money home and, building a mansion.
So he's not Spiro Agnew. There were no envelopes of cash being handed to him in his office. I do think that's what he meant when he said that.
And where does this stand in terms of national political implications? Are there national political implications beyond the fate of Congressman Rangel and his New York primary?
I think there definitely are. It feeds this impression among many voters that Washington's kind of a swamp. You can't trust anyone there. Throw the bums out. That sentiment we've already seen in this country, that hurts Democrats more than Republicans because Democrats are the ones in power. We also see this stream of emails from groups like the National Republican Congressional Committee targeting members of Congress who accepted money from Rangel's PAC, saying it's dirty money. So some of them have returned it. Some of them have contributed to charity. There are definitely efforts to have this man's individual trial become something that fuels the perception that we really need to clean up Washington.
Which I guess for the Democratic Party's sake is why he still might make some kind of a deal. Proposition 8 and the Arizona immigration law both struck down in court. Here are people on both sides of the California gay marriage ban, now ruled to be a violation of the state constitution.
I do feel like I live in a dictatorship now, that my vote doesn't count. My vote didn't matter. Why did I go out to the polls and vote for Prop 8 when one unelected judge can just overturn that?
Our courts are supposed to protect our constitutional rights. They did. Every American should be proud.
Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today, with us as we review the news of the last 2 weeks, now that I'm back from vacation. And Susan, this is not the last word in either of these cases. Do you see the Prop 8 decision having any national political implications?
Well, it's had some already in that there were several states that were rushing to pass Arizona-style laws. There's been a kind of hold put on some of those in Idaho, in Utah, in Ohio, and in some other places because the judge's decision was pretty broad. The judge's decision said immigration is a federal matter. It's not a matter for states. You pass laws like this, it infringes on the federal government's ability to deal with this issue. So she's made it hard for other states to see a path to moving forward, and I think there's been a little bit of a pullback on the part of other states with the idea of going ahead. Now, there are 9 states that are supporting the filed briefs supporting Arizona's position, and Arizona is appealing the judge's decision, but I think it's had a little bit of a cooling off effect.
So that's on the Arizona law. And on Proposition 8, we have a few callers on this. Matt in Clifton, you're on WNYC. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Good. You were going to mention that it was overturned, Proposition 8, the California gay marriage ban, obviously a big thing in the last 2 weeks.
Oh, yeah, huge. You know, constitutional life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. You know, those things are pretty important to everybody. So glad to see it happen.
Thank you very much. Kim in Brooklyn on the same topic. Hi, Kim.
Hi, welcome back.
Thank you.
I also agree with Matt from Clifton. I guess two things that are brought up to me is that whenever you ask people who are against gay marriage, what's the problem? Why is it, they just seem to can't come up with a logical reason? And I think the judge proved that in his ruling that it's a moral feeling and it's separating church and religion. And also that as a lesbian myself, I wonder, you know, why do I'm a taxpaying citizen, yet I don't have the same opportunities as everyone else. And it is discrimination.
Kim, thank you. And Susan Page again, national political implications of that. Does this rub off on President Obama or anyone else?
Well, President Obama has been extremely cautious on the question of same-sex marriage. He's supported domestic partnerships but not supported same-sex marriage. Well, you know, one of the surprising things that I've seen happen since the judge's decision in California is that neither side seems very eager to talk about this. I think Democrats don't see this as a winning political issue with independent voters. But it's been interesting that Republicans have not really seized on it. And I think that's because they see the economy as their number one issue this year. In a way, they don't want to be diverted to the issue of gay marriage. And in that way, this decision by the judge, which has incredible potential repercussions across the country, has not become a flashpoint in the political debate the way you might have expected.
And this question about whether the judge himself is gay and whether that taints the decision, I mean, it would be the same question if the judge was heterosexual.
That's right. And neither side raised this issue during the course of the trial. And my understanding, although I'm no lawyer, is that that means it cannot be raised in the appeals. So it's a subject mostly, I guess, for the press.
I guess so. Certainly a lot of blah, blah, blah about that out there. Not that I think his sexual orientation has even been established, but to raise the question that way seems to me that being heterosexual is neutral and being gay is potentially biased.
Yeah. And, you know, as we talked about how the judge's decision in Arizona had a broad basis that was a warning sign to other states, you know, the judge's decision in California also very interesting. The argument was that the 14th Amendment provides equal protection of the laws, and there was no rational basis for the state to ban same-sex marriage. Some legal analysts thought this argument was said this argument was very made with a lot of information, a lot of detail, very carefully argued. It was an easy decision to read. I read the conclusion, which was very understandable. And they say it was written for Justice Kennedy, because if this case gets to the Supreme Court, the thinking is Justice Kennedy will be the swing vote on it. It was written in a way, these legal analysts say, to appeal to that particular person.
Here are some of the things from the last 2 weeks that our listeners are chiming in with that I missed. Norma on our Facebook page, you missed Elena Kagan's being voted onto the Supreme Court. I may not live to see women as president, writes Norma, but 3 women on the court isn't chopped liver. Freddie writes the border skirmish between Lebanon and Israel. Paula from Manhattan, the Senate passed the child nutrition bill with unanimous consent. What was in that bill? That was the U.S. Senate, right?
The child nutrition bill?
Yeah.
You know, I'm afraid I don't know.
Okay. Meredith from Mount Vernon overturn of Prop 8, Kagan's confirmation, closing of the BP oil well. How about BP? It's still plenty bad, obviously, but I wonder if the politics have changed with last week's report showing 75% of this worst oil spill accident in history has already dissipated, or if it seems exaggerated now in retrospect when we in the media kept saying worst oil, you know, worst environmental disaster in history over and over again, and now in a few weeks' time, 75% of it is gone.
It's kind of like, never mind all that previous coverage. You know, as you mentioned, I think earlier in this hour, there's some skepticism about whether we can trust that the disaster is really over. But boy, what a surprise with that government report last week that said 75% of the oil has basically gone away. Now, the 25% of the oil that's still left, it's still four times the amount of oil that was leaked by the Exxon Valdez. So it's still a terrible spill, but it does not seem like the unbelievable catastrophe that we thought. And I don't know if that's because we overplayed it. I mean, we were reporting what scientists and politicians and others were telling us, or whether there's some, self-healing mechanism in the oceans. I mean, I guess I'm a little perplexed at what to make of the fact that this disaster seems to be resolving itself.
And all of a sudden, the fact that it's warm water in the Gulf as opposed to the cold waters in Alaska from the Exxon Valdez spill, which dissipated more slowly, seems to be a big thing. Why weren't we talking about warm waters before, possibly mitigating the effects? Were people trying to be alarmist for political reasons? On the other hand, we don't know yet for how many years some of these fisheries are going to be out of commission. And so, we don't know the effect on human beings as well as on wildlife.
We probably don't know more than we knew when we were perhaps overstating the effect of this spill. But, boy, this is a story I would love for us to have been wrong on and to have this be a less disastrous situation for the folks in the Gulf than we thought it was going to be.
All right. Andrew in the Bronx has a story I missed. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Brian. How are you? I'm actually heading over right now in my car to our new bridge. It's finally being installed. The only freeway to get in and out of the city, if you take the Willis Avenue Bridge. I cross that bridge 2-3 times a day, and every time I'm sitting there on there at a dead stop, I think that's the day that my family will be sitting shiva because this thing could collapse out from under me.
Oh, my God. Was it that bad? And of course, there are various crossings.
Infrastructure. So
sorry?
I'm very happy we have this new bridge.
Good.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you very much. Yes, there are various crossings over the Harlem River. Madison Avenue Bridge is another one. But hooray for the new Willis Avenue Bridge. Roberta in Rockland, you're on WNYC. Hi, Roberta.
Hi, Brian. Welcome back.
Thank you.
The death of the man who invented one of the greatest snacks of all time, the cheese doodle. Mari Yohai lived till 99 years and gave us all that wonderful snacks, including the cheese doodle. May he rest in peace.
Thank you very much. Well, if Mari Yohai, Susan Page, lived to 99 years old, he must have eaten a lot of not cheese doodles.
I think that's probably right. We do love the cheese doodle, but I think it is something we're supposed to show moderation on.
Principal Joy in Manhattan has one. Hey, Principal Joy, it's been a while. Thanks for calling.
Yes, how are you?
Okay, and you?
Welcome back.
Thank you.
I liked Brancaccio.
Good.
Okay.
We all like Brancaccio.
I'm talking about the controversy with Michelle Obama going to Spain.
Uh-huh. And? Give me your take on it.
Well, I have no objection to it, but there does seem to have been a controversy, even including Maureen Dowd. I haven't read her article as yet.
Principal,
but I plan to.
Thank you very much. So, Susan, what was that about?
Well, Michelle Obama and her younger daughter, they've just, I think, returned this morning from a trip to Spain, a private trip, a vacation with two of Michelle Obama's friends and four of their daughters. They took a government plane. That's caused some controversy. They stayed in a 5-star resort. They paid for their own rooms, although the taxpayer paid for security and aides who were with her. So it seemed, I think, tone deaf, maybe, at a time when unemployment's near 10% and a lot of Americans are struggling, tone deaf to be on that vacation, although her defenders note that she went as a private citizen, wanted to spend time with her daughter, all admirable things. But what do we call them? The optics. The optics seemed a little off.
Joel from Washington Heights writes, wheat futures reached their highest prices in 2 years, and this on the heels of a single hedge fund called Armajaro Asset Management gaining control of 240,000 tons of cocoa, or 7% of annual global production. Agricultural markets may be safe for low-risk investors, but is this speculation safe for consumers? Do you have any knowledge of this story?
Well, actually, what I thought had happened with wheat futures, and I speak as someone who was born and raised in Kansas, so I've spent my life around wheat, is that the Russian government has moved to block Russian exports of wheat. They've had terrible weather there, as I'm sure you've heard. It's really affected the wheat harvest. This is having the effect of driving up wheat prices around the country, but farmers back in Kansas, including my cousin, who operates our family farm, are now having to decide whether to plant more wheat. They've been really moving toward corn, because ethanol has driven up the price of corn.
And Sandra from Brooklyn says, Wyclef Jean running for president of Haiti. You missed that. Well, we may have missed it, but we're going to do a segment on that later in this hour, specifically asking, can the former Fuji run Haiti? And you mentioned daughters a few minutes ago, talking about Michelle Obama. Rudy's daughter getting busted for shoplifting. I mean, he was the apostle of the broken windows theory here in New York, as you remember when you used to work for Newsday, arresting people for little crimes like turnstile jumping to prevent more serious crimes. But the store, Sephora, declined to press charges. Is this a story outside New York?
I don't think so. You know, for two reasons. Number one, I think people are inclined to give kids of public figures who are not in public life themselves a bit of a break. And also because Rudy Giuliani is no longer a public official. So while I'm personally aware of that story, I haven't seen a lot of coverage of it outside New York City.
Susan Page, D.C. Bureau Chief for USA Today. Thank you for being my first guest back from vacation and helping us with this whirlwind tour of the last 2 weeks.
Hey, Brian, thank you. Next time you should warn us when you're going to go away so we can be braced for big news.
All this big news. Thanks again, Susan. And I will mention one other thing, and that is that the U.S. National Ultimate Frisbee Team for age 19 and under won the gold medal on Saturday at the International Championship Tournament in Heilbronn, Germany. That's the fifth straight world championship for the U.S. Teenage Ultimate Team, the second in a row under head coach and Brian Lehrer Show producer Jody Avergon, who was also away for the last 2 weeks. So congratulations, Jody. Congratulations, Jody, just back from that exciting vacation and gold medal performance. The score of the final game, by the way, was USA 17, Canada 7. No steroids in ultimate frisbee that we know of, but sadly, everyone will remember A-Rod's 600th homer, and almost no one will remember this. Well, we'll continue in a minute with a closer look at something related to one of the stories that happened when I was away, the mosque and cultural center proposed for Ground Zero, denounced by the Anti-Defamation League, but approved by the Landmarks Preservation Commission. But there are other mosques not near Ground Zero that are meeting with similar opposition. Why? We'll ask that question.